Welcome once again to episode 12, the final episode of Life Without Consequence. This is a science fiction audiobook disguised as a podcast. And my name is Davey Francis. I am your host, your author, and your narrator. Endings are difficult. Sticking the landing is, in my opinion, one of the hardest parts of storytelling. That being said, I hope you enjoyed the conclusion to this story. Not everyone made it out of this adventure alive, but I hope you like where those who did have found themselves. I wanted to say something here to give a little insight into what this book means, what this story is about, and what it's trying to say. I wrote several different versions of this intro and wasn't satisfied with anything I wrote. I don't think this book has one clear definition. This is a silly, irreverent idea I had that grew in severity with every sentence I wrote. It was supposed to be a comedy complete with dick and piss jokes, but my life got serious while I was writing it, and in turn, the story did too. I hope this story made you feel things. I hope you wanted to smack Parker upside the head for being incapable of getting out of his own way. I hope your heart dropped when Nina was ripped out through that door or when Benj spoke for the first time. I hope it made you audibly mutter what the fuck to yourself with every weird new escalation of an already weird story. I hope you're as conflicted as I am about what Parker and Benj have decided their future is going to be now. Most of all, I hope you had fun. I hope this was an adventure you didn't want to end. I didn't want it to end. I'm not through with this world and this story. There is a sequel to this book in the works, but you might have to wait a little while to hear me tell you that tale, though. Thank you to my producers, Hampus, Andrew McGuire, and Cole Biffle. Thank you, everyone, for spending 9 of your human hours with me. And thank you for being here right now to get into hour 10. With all that being said, one last time, for now, welcome back to Life Without Consequence. Chapter 39, Nina. Nina's fingertips felt sweaty as she clutched the cracked plastic clipboard. She tried to answer the questions written on the forms, but every time she thought about the answers, she found her brain retreating into the white noise of the hospital. Pages coming over the PA, the symphony of different beeping sounds that surrounded her. The way the whispers of 30 people in a waiting room can somehow become deafening. She knew what she was supposed to write. She knew the name, but she didn't want to write it. Instead, Nina thought about the pain that would shoot through her cheek every time she attempted to shift her expression. She'd go back to the terrifying sight of an eyeball in a man's chest, glaring at her as she lay shackled and gagged on the floor of a room surrounded by an impossible infinity. She thought about the last thing she'd said to him. "Get off my property." But she couldn't bring herself to write his name. Billy walked past and offered her a paper cup of vending machine coffee. She noticed him glancing at the empty forms as he took a seat next to her.
"He's gonna be all right," Billy said reassuringly.
He wasn't, though. Tucker was dead. The guy in the hospital bed looked just like him, exactly like him. She didn't understand it, but after the past 24 hours, Nina had given up on trying to understand anything. Everybody was acting like it was all over, but it wasn't. Now they were all trapped in this nexus of insanity that she was being asked to perpetuate by lying. She wanted to mourn. She wanted to get together with people who knew him and cry. Nina knew that Tucker hadn't been anyone's favorite person for a very long time. But that was one of the finite upsides to death. The reprieve from negativity when people shrugged off all the trivial problems they had with someone in life and just celebrated the good parts. Amongst all the bad, Tucker had so many good parts. Christ, she wasn't even allowed to tell his parents. She had to keep the secret. What had happened had been terrible. But it wasn't what the bad feeling she'd had was warning her about. The bad feeling had been warning her about this.
"Hey, sweetie, can I take those forms from you?"
said a nurse with a bedside manner of a saint.
"Oh, I'm sorry," Nina said, stuttering the words. "I was miles away. I'll be 1 minute."
The nurse just smiled and gave the slightest nod to confirm that everything was fine and Nina could take as long as she wanted. As soon as her back was turned, though, Nina's smile evaporated and she scrunched up her entire face trying to hold back tears. She felt Billy's arm around her shoulder, pulling her closer to him over the arm of the uncomfortable waiting room chair. He pulled the clipboard out of her hands and set it on the chair beside him.
"It's not fair," she whispered. "He deserves better than this."
Billy nodded and rubbed her shoulder until the double doors on the other side of the room buzzed open. Bench, the guy who'd gotten her away from Brendan, walked through looking ambivalent to all of this. He was the one that had told her about what Tucker had done, how he'd showed up and saved them all, how he'd sacrificed himself so everyone, including her, could be safe. He'd told her about where he and his friend Parker were from and how they'd gotten here. It was funny. 24 hours ago, she would have laughed him out of the building for saying some of the things he'd said. Now, every time she felt herself taken by a bout of skepticism, her mind forced her to think about Brendan transforming and the room in their house that felt like it was as big as the entire universe. Benj had told her what she was supposed to do. The lie. The secret. He'd made it sound so harmless.
"They said it's safe to go in and see him," he said.
Nina narrowed her eyes curiously as he motioned with his fists like he was tying a giant bow. She thought it looked like sign language.
"You know, if you want,"
he added when he was met with silence from both Nina and Billy. She hadn't spoken to Parker at all. He'd been unconscious when the ambulance arrived, and Benj had monopolized her attention, filling her in on the details of the chaos her life would now be embroiled in. It would have probably been a better idea to take a little time to think before speaking to him. But Nina had some things she wanted to say, and she wanted to say them right then and there. Nina stood up, brushing her hair behind her ear nervously.
"Can I speak to him alone?"
she asked. Benj paused momentarily, but eventually just shrugged.
"Sure,
he'd probably like that," he said, but Nina didn't know what he meant by it. Ben showed her to the room they'd put Parker in. He was hooked up to several machines, each one monitoring a different one of his vital signs. Blood pressure, heart rate, O2 levels. His injuries had been pretty extensive. On top of all the internal damage, Parker had earned himself a couple broken bones. His left leg had been set in a splint and raised in traction after his tibia was determined to be broken. They'd put a cast on his left arm, which now hung in a sling across his chest. He looked awful. When he saw she'd entered the room, he tried to sit up straighter, but was mostly confined to the single position he'd been placed in.
"Hi,"
he said, in a groggy and oddly familiar voice.
"Hello,"
she said in reply. They were on the verge of entering what some people would have called an awkward silence. Parker pulled them away from it by wiggling his shoulder.
"I broke my humerus," he proclaimed.
She stared at him, unsure how to respond. He somehow did and didn't sound like Tucker all at once.
"Yeah, forget it. I didn't think it was funny either," he said,
then cracked a smile like he was embarrassed with himself for making such a bad pun. Nina didn't feel like laughing, but she forced it a little in hopes of making him feel better.
"I wanted to say thank you," she said. "You know, for helping me."
The smile dropped off of his face now, and he looked at her with genuine seriousness.
"You don't know me, and you didn't have to do that," Nina continued. "Of course, it was nothing, you know, I was just happy to help,"
he said and tried to laugh, which clearly hurt.
"It was so much more than nothing. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for you."
And then she paused to take a breath, mentally shaping the words that would follow. "But neither of us would be here if it hadn't been for Tucker." He looked at her strangely, like she'd said something confusing. I don't understand why you look the way you do. And while I appreciate what you did, you don't just get to be him now. She tried to make eye contact during that part, to make sure he knew she meant it. Parker mumbled several confused versions of agreeing with her, and then fell quiet. Whatever you do next, I'd really appreciate if you left me alone. Please. She hadn't planned on saying that part. Looking him in the eye right there gave her a small taste of the sadness she was going to feel every time she looked at him after that. Parker pursed his lips and nodded slowly.
Yeah, I can do that. Whatever's best for you, Parker said.
And then Nina turned to see Ben standing in the doorway. Thanks, she said quietly to him. I'm done now. And then she left.
Chapter 40 by Elle. It was once a two-story, three-bedroom in one of Las Vegas's top five wealthiest neighborhoods. But that was a long time ago. Depending on where things began for you, it might actually be a long time from now. Whenever it may have been, the home could now boast the accolade of having not entirely fallen to pieces after being disassembled at the atomic level, transported interdimensionally, and reassembled on another planet. This was a remarkable house. It was almost as remarkable as the rage that had fueled Bael's attempt to raise the building to the dusty grounds of Tharsis, a volcanic plateau in Mars's eastern hemisphere. He had survived for over a century, but Bael had never felt a wave of anger like this before. Through war, famine, and genocide, he had persevered. It was inconceivable to him that a group of Earth's humans could not only escape death at his hands, but strand him on this cursed world to wait for rescue. Mars had once been a vibrant planet, full of life and potential. Generation after generation of beings grew, evolved, and advanced over a millennium. Empires rose and fell there like the wax and wane of its moons. For the briefest of moments, in terms of infinity, the Empire of Mars thought it might conquer the entire galaxy. Not one of their greatest scholars ever perceived that the universe's ongoing expansion would be their undoing. As Mars gradually drifted further away from the warm light of the sun, the utopia it had become descended into chaos. Light diminished, temperatures dropped, and as Mars's plight grew more dire, its citizens' instinct for survival took precedent. It didn't take long before they discarded their idyllic way of life in favor of violence. Tharsis had become a place for dead things and monsters. Monsters like Bael. Back then, the denizens of this dying world were only monsters in the figurative sense of the word. It wasn't until the Heralds of Infinity appeared on the planet with their keys and prophecies that Mars's people were given the opportunity to realize their full and hideous potential. The Heralds selected their flock and contorted the people of Mars into a collection of grotesque instruments. Among them, they found Bael to be the sharpest and most valuable. They said it was destiny, that it had already happened and would happen 100,000 times over. They said it was written in the wastes of existence that festered between the scales of a serpent that had and would continue to consume itself for all of time. Bael lived to bask in the fear of others. What he allowed someone and the Heralds to do to him just made it all that much easier. Their gifts were not without cost. The Martian people were indebted to the Heralds, and servitude would be their payment. For a century, Bael had obeyed his masters without question, for his principals rarely asked him of anything more than simply doing what he loved. That all changed, though, when he was sent to Earth. Wait, they said. Behave, they commanded. Stark contrast to the requests of kill and destroy he was accustomed to. Was it punishment? Bael had wondered. Had he somehow fallen in poor favor of the Heralds? What had he done to deserve this? How could the keepers of the keys to all reality have allowed him to suffer like this? Never in a million lifetimes could an insignificant thing like Parker Luderi
have brought any actual harm to Bael. He was a walking collection of scars that had become so accustomed to physical pain, he now felt lonely without it. The humiliation, though, was a new type of pain that triggered a primal rage, the likes of which he hadn't felt for decades. It was bad enough that they'd somehow outsmarted him, trapping him on another world in another reality. But the audacity of delivering him to this building was unforgivable. It reeked of their scent. Its walls were covered with pictures of their faces. It could not be allowed to remain standing. Now unburdened by the hideous human mask he'd been forced to wear, Bael used the entirety of his strength to destroy this effigy to the people who had wronged him. Lost entirely to rage, Bael couldn't tell if it had taken hours or days, but when he was finished, the building was unrecognizable. He stood still as a corpse, marveling at the rubble and letting the frozen silence of a Martian night wash over him. He could feel the prying eyes of inquisitive locals begin to rest on him, the creatures that had been left to watch over this husk of a planet. They knew who he was, what he was capable of. He could taste their fear. It was carried to him on the breeze and taunted his senses. The terror of creatures that rarely experienced it themselves was a delicacy Bael rarely saw anymore. But Bael did not move. He did not stir a single muscle for them. It was a gap in the sensation that drew his attention. The scent of something that was beyond simple confidence. Something that lacked anything even slightly reminiscent of fear. The applause came before his brain had delivered the impulses to his limbs. A slow clap drenched in contempt. "Well," someone said, continuing to applaud. "That was quite a finale." Bael turned towards the familiar voice. With his eyes still lowered, he took deep, slow breaths, trying to remain calm in this entity's presence. Even at his most feral, Bael knew how to conduct himself in the presence of a herald. Someone's appearance roused a litany of questions in Bael's thoughts, but they were all erased when he heard that word. Finale. He slowly raised his eyes towards his maker and saw the smile.
"Did you know?" Bael asked.
Unlike their last meeting, he no longer communicated like a human. The language of man was tied to a body Bael was no longer attached to. It was an undulating throb that came from deep within him.
"You were told to be discreet," someone said, in the language of its own creation. "Did you know?"
Bael screamed. Someone took a deep breath, pulling a little bit of the universe inside of itself. The outburst seemed to have taken it by surprise.
"Of course we knew. We know all, Bael," someone responded, with a tone that was meant to communicate superiority.
Bael studied the herald. He watched the cloak of nothingness drift about, unburdened by simple things like gravity. He looked into the cavernous black voids that sat where the eyes of humans did, and saw the detachment in someone for the first time. The complete lack of investment. Pieces to a puzzle that he had never thought to solve began falling into place. There was no grand purpose to what he was, what he'd been made into. It hit him like a ton of bricks. He, the people of Mars, and what Bael assumed to be innumerable other civilizations had been simply entertainment, a source of amusement for things that exist beyond the comprehensions of life, living, and dying. Bael clenched his fists, looked someone dead in the eye, and began to scream with the fury of 10,000 suns. He felt his muscles begin to actuate, the small microtransactions that occurred between synapses. In one single moment, Bael felt a lifetime of humiliation well up and start to explode in the form of a stampede meant to end with the beheading of a god.
"Oh, Bael," someone muttered, as it watched the Martian begin to lunge.
The herald waved its hand dismissively. and Bael ceased to exist entirely. There was no pageantry to it. He was just gone. The herald shook its head in an all-too-human way that might have meant it was disappointed. It looked at the rubble that used to be a home before turning to look down the hallway of a hospital at a dark-skinned man who looked as though making a decision as simple as selecting a snack from a vending machine might break him in two. Chapter 41. Benj. He was leering at a vending machine when it occurred to Benj that leaving Nina alone with Parker might not have been the best idea. Shit, he muttered to himself, peering back down the hallway and contemplating whether or not he should intervene. The silence Benj had adopted for the majority of his adult life forced him down a path of least resistance in most situations. Getting involved with something once the ball was rolling always felt like it would cause more problems than it solved as a mute. But he wasn't mute anymore. Benj was now more capable of walking right into that room and verbally expressing how bad of an idea he thought it was that the two of them interacted in any way, shape, or form. He didn't, though. He stayed in the hallway, staring at the vast array of snacks in front of him, trying not to break down and cry at the sight of a bag of chips that cost less than $15. Parker had been obsessed with Nina, and she'd been obsessed with him. Benj couldn't ever tell if they actually liked each other, but the obsession they shared was blatant and wholly unhealthy. Now she was gone, and Parker had only barely begun to scratch the surface of his grief. The last thing he thought his old friend needed was Nina's doppelganger from a parallel universe stopping by for a visit. Is that what was happening? He wondered. Was it a parallel universe? In terms of the impossible, Benj was struggling to think of anything that was off the table anymore. The possibilities were endless, and while Benj's mind wandered off into the realm of fantasies that might now be his reality, he failed to notice a person approaching behind him. "Too many options," someone said. Startled from his brief daydream, Benj spun around and saw a man of indeterminable age wrapped in a black cloak. It reminded him of a Buddhist monk he'd seen in one of the old issues of National Geographic that his parents had collected. Black wasn't the appropriate word, though. It was darker than that. It seized Benj's thoughts and transported him back to his childhood, curiously staring up at the inky pool of darkness the Midwest had become a lifetime before he'd been born. It was hypnotic. Unable to find words, Benj turned back and non-verbally stuttered about the vending machine behind him. It was somewhere between an actual sign and just wildly pointing. The pale man in the robes just smiled like he was watching a performance he thoroughly enjoyed. "It's just that," he finally managed to say, but the pale man didn't let him finish. "Like nothing you've ever seen before." It was a vastly unusual thing to say to a stranger. But as Benj glanced again at the selection of snacks displayed behind him, he noted to himself that it was an unsettlingly astute observation. Not only about the vending machine, but also about how he felt entirely in that moment. As the pale man continued to smile, Benj felt a creeping fear take him by surprise. Like when you've convinced yourself that you're being watched, but know with 100% certainty that you're alone. Benj edged away from the man whose eyes followed him, like the eyes of a haunted painting. The robes draped over his slight frame seemed to radiate darkness as his enjoyment of the encounter grew. Benj glanced back down the hallway towards Parker's room, hoping to see Nina and use her as an excuse to remove himself from this interaction. She didn't appear, but when Benj turned to look upon the pale man once more, he found that her assistance wouldn't be needed. The man and his black hole robes were gone, but the crawling of Benj's skin didn't cease. The phone in his pocket, Brendan's phone, buzzed and startled him. Benj fumbled the device out of his jeans and looked at the screen. There was a notification of a text message from a name that had been saved simply as someone. He didn't think the phone worked anymore. Just like the one that had brought them to Cleveland, it too had died during its last use. Overloaded and burnt out after banishing the Brendan monster to Tharsis. "Like nothing you've ever seen," he said, reading the message aloud to himself. Benj looked up and down the hallway suspiciously, and suddenly feeling like he didn't want to be alone anymore, walked quickly in the direction of Parker and Nina, who had already spent more than enough time together. Chapter 42. Parker and Benj. Benj watched Nina disappear down the hall, then turned to find Parker furiously clicking a button attached to the end of a long wire.
"What are you doing?" he asked. "There's supposed to be pain meds when I press this. It worked before, now it's busted."
Parker frustratedly clicked the button several more times, then tossed it off of the bed and sighed.
"What did she say to you?"
Benj asked of Parker and Nina's conversation.
"She said thank you, and then she told me we need to kick rocks," Parker replied.
"I think my face upsets her." Then he laughed. But it wasn't really a laugh. Ben shook his head.
"And that's funny?"
"Not funny, ha-ha funny," he said.
"Her face upsets me too. But I like looking at it."
Benj knew he shouldn't have left Nina alone with him. "She thinks I might try and steal Tucker's life because..." Parker attempted to gesture towards his face with his less injured arm. Benj cocked his head to the side and raised his eyebrows accusingly. He knew his friend all too well.
"Of course I thought about it. I mean, he doesn't need it anymore," Parker confessed before quickly changing the subject.
"Did you give away our hero moment?"
Benj cringed a little. "Sorry. Tucker went out pretty rough. I figured these people might want a good final memory of him."
"It's fine. Probably better than the truth anyway," Parker said, shaking his head and rolling his eyes as he lay back into the pile of pillows that propped him up. Benj narrowed his eyes curiously, not privy to this particular insight.
"He didn't come back to help anyone but himself," Parker clarified sardonically.
"He just wanted a ticket to the future."
"Speaking of the future," Benj said,
"what do you want to do now?"
"I don't know," Parker replied. "Go home? Is that an option?"
From the pocket of a very obviously borrowed pair of jeans, Benj pulled out a sleek black cell phone with a polished gold rim that ran around the outside of the screen. The device came to life with a click, displaying the symbol of a snake eating its own tail.
"It's an option,"
Benj confirmed with a noncommittal tone and a shrug. Parker looked away. The sight of the device triggered flashbacks to the atrocities they'd witnessed since one just like it fell into their hands. He thought, for a moment, about what he'd said to Brendan out on Nina's driveway, how it was nothing but trouble. He'd meant it. He felt like everything in his life had begun to implode from the moment they'd found it. Of course, his life had been slowly imploding for quite some time. The device was just an elaborate new excuse for Parker to avoid taking responsibility.
"We don't really have a home to go back to, Parker," Benj said.
"I was thinking maybe we could just stay here."
"Here? Seriously, Benj? We saw what I can only describe as a literal fucking demon rip a man in half. A man that, may I add, looked just like me. I've had to deal with some pretty heinous shit in Vegas, but never anything like this."
Benj paused briefly, thinking back to the strange man he'd met in the hallway.
"I don't think going home's gonna stop this kind of stuff from happening anymore, Parker," he said,
then held the device up again, making sure Parker looked at it.
"I think we've unlocked some kind of door by using this thing. And I think all the things on the other side of that door are gonna start finding us, regardless of where we are. At least it's comfortable here."
Parker grunted as he shuffled uncomfortably against the stiff, overly starched hospital sheets. He'd spent over a decade relying on finger signs and facial expressions to interpret what Benj was trying to communicate. That always gave him a little room to translate the meaning in his favor. But Parker couldn't do that anymore. Benj's words were as clear as crystal.
"Benj, look at me. We barely survived this, and..."
He paused, looking down at the floor while he decided on how to elucidate his thoughts. Parker knew that what lurked in the shadows of the broken reality he now called home would eventually come out of the darkness. He knew Brendan probably wouldn't be the last monster he'd see in his lifetime. And he knew that made him a dangerous person to be close to.
"I just don't want to see anyone else get hurt. And as long as we're around, with that fucking thing, people will get hurt."
There was something Parker wasn't saying.
He wasn't lying or leaving anything out. But when he'd said people, he clearly meant Nina. Parker knew himself well enough to know that regardless of how many times she'd ask him to stay away, he wouldn't listen. Parker regarded his friend with genuine seriousness. I can't watch it happen again. He stammered as he said it, a high-pitched crack cutting through the bass in his voice. I can't. There was a long silence between them after that. Benj stood, turning the phone over and over in his hand until he'd worked up enough courage to say something he knew Parker wouldn't want to hear. She's not Nina, Parker. Not your Nina. It wasn't that he didn't care if any of the people they'd met got hurt. Quite the opposite. What Benj needed was for Parker to understand, without a shadow of a doubt, that the woman they had rescued was not the same woman they'd known since they were children. I know, Parker responded, finally having calmed the shaking in his voice. But she's pretty fucking close. And that's why I can't be here. And that's why we need to go home and face whatever's waiting for us back there. Benj pursed his lips together, rolling them inwards as he slowly nodded his head. He noted, silently to himself, that Parker hadn't even veered slightly towards the idea of destroying the device. It stood out to Benj because he hadn't thought of it either. Despite being the source of so much danger and madness, the device turned their unfortunate lives into something special. Benj knew that neither of them was willing to go back to anything that resembled a normal life ever again. It didn't matter where they were, or the consequences. Okay, Parker, Benj said. We'll go home. And that was that. There would be no more discussion. When Parker was healed, he and Benj would travel back to 2076, to the street-level slums of Las Vegas, and face whatever consequences waited for them there. Epilogue. 1 year later. Parker and Benj. The stratosphere had, at one point, been the tallest freestanding structure in the Northern Hemisphere. Located on the border of Paradise and Las Vegas proper, it became a hybrid neutral ground for locals and tourists alike, up until 2038, when the casino and hotel was forced to close its doors. As a hotbed for microquakes, the structural integrity of Las Vegas properties was perpetually being tested by the planet's tectonic plates. This constant barrage of tremors eventually led to the catastrophic failure of the Stratosphere Observation Deck's longest-running thrill ride, the X-Scream. A simple attraction, built from a 68-foot piece of conventional roller coaster track that seesawed back and forth on the edge of the tower. An open-top car full of adrenaline junkies would, without warning, roll forward, creating the feeling that the riders might be headed right off the precipice of the building. The car would stop suddenly at the edge of the track and leave its riders to enjoy the view before tilting back and returning them to safety. All up until the time that it didn't. The blame was placed on the maintenance crews for not doing their jobs. That wasn't entirely untrue, but cuts in pay combined with long hours set by property management certainly didn't inspire anyone working at the Stratosphere to perform at their highest capabilities. On August 19th, 2038, a car carrying 8 riders failed to stop at the edge of the track and proceeded to plummet 866 feet onto the busy Las Vegas Boulevard located below. The Stratosphere closed its doors the following day. Naturally, there were lawsuits, fines, counter-lawsuits. It was a time of extreme economic downturn,
and everyone who thought they might be able to extract a payday from Silver Entertainment, the owners of the Stratosphere at the time, tried to get one. Never the most swiftly moving at the best of times, court proceedings surrounding the Stratosphere kept the doors closed all the way up until the start of World War III, when all of Las Vegas's casinos were either purchased by the military or repurposed by the city as power plants. It still looked like Las Vegas on the outside, but the inside of its casinos had become industrial complexes with nary a slot machine in sight. Despite the news telling a very different story, the United States never recovered economically after the war. The states as individual bodies were left to fend for themselves almost as autonomous governments, some even successfully succeeding to form entirely new countries. See, the United States of Kentucky. Las Vegas never reopened as an oasis of debauchery. They turned the lights back on to keep up appearances, but behind the bright veneers were just a collection of people trying to ride out what seemed like the quickly approaching end of the world. Some managed it more comfortably than others. Money didn't lose its power just because the planet was dying. Private corporations began to develop the high-rise communities, and those able to get up and away from street level took advantage. The most visually striking of all the towers was the Mesosphere, a reconstruction and rebranding of the old Stratosphere property. After being deemed a potential target for terrorist attack, the original Stratosphere had been imploded and bulldozed in early 2043. They had expected an uproar of protest in opposition of removing one of the most visually striking parts of the Las Vegas skyline, but that never happened. Apathy had already sunk its claws into the residents of Sin City. The land was sold to a private development firm, who left the two city blocks vacant until 2053, an entire decade after the Stratosphere's demolition. This was when they announced and began construction of the Mesosphere, 3 60-story community towers that would house thousands of families in need of homes up and away from the streets. The crown jewel of the Mesosphere was the observation deck, a one-to-one recreation of the original Stratosphere deck that now floated majestically at the center of the three towers. It was the first domestic use of magnetic levitation technology, something that had only been used by the military up until this point. Construction was completed in 2057, and by 2060, there was a 5-year waiting list for even the studios on the lower levels. It was reviewed by many as one of the safest towers to live, and quickly became, like the Stratosphere before it, the symbol of Las Vegas. Some things don't change, though, and the plates of the Earth don't cease movement because there's a shiny new building. Small shifts in the bedrock turned the floating observation deck into a tragedy waiting to happen. It needed to be monitored 24/7, and maglev recalibration was performed on almost a daily basis. The problems continued until 2074, when for the first time since opening, safety cables were added to the structure, in the event of what was quietly behind the scenes being considered an inevitable failure. It was New Year's 2076 when it finally happened, during the annual fireworks display. There was no warning. It just began to fall. The maglev engine on Tower 2 slipped just barely out of range, which caused the platform to tip. It was caught by the safety supports, but the sudden lunge played out like dominoes, with the engines on Towers 1 and 3 quickly falling from range and away from the maglev system. The supports held momentarily, but they were never designed to hold the weight of the entire platform and 500 VIP guests in attendance that night. Just like the X-Screen before, the Mesosphere observation deck plummeted to the ground beneath and took all three towers down with it. There were no survivors, and their memorial was a seemingly never-ending cloud of dust and debris that covered the majority of the city. Parker coughed and tried to shield his eyes with the wilted bouquet of flowers he held in his hands. "Can you see anything?" he called to the silhouette of Benj, who he'd been trailing behind. "I think it's up this way," his friend called back. The cloud caused by the collapse of the Mesosphere made the streets of Las Vegas even harder to navigate than they'd ever been. Between the constant yellow haze and thicker clouds of debris being carried around on the wind, Parker barely recognized the old neighborhood. It was shocking that this part of town could ever look any more apocalyptic. Parker squinted up the street at the shape of his friend, which grew and diminished with clarity as the wind played with the density of the cloud
like watching an old television set struggle to maintain signal. A big gust came out of nowhere and knocked Parker off balance, but it briefly gave him a little more clarity. For a moment, he could see the big empty space where their house had once stood. Lenny's car was still parked awkwardly in front. It had been stripped of anything that might have been valuable, but still somehow looked like the nicest thing on the block. It took the breath out of Parker for a moment. He'd been putting off the visit for some time now. He and Benj would make plans to go, but then Parker would figure out some sort of excuse and push it back a few more weeks. He'd been doing this for 12 whole months now, but after a stern talking to from Benj, Parker finally conceded that the anniversary was important. As far as the world was concerned, Nina and Lenny had just vanished. Parker tried to rationalize the guilt, to make it hurt less, but there wasn't any way he could spin it that made him feel like he was any less to blame for what happened to them. As far as Parker was concerned, he'd killed them both himself. Parker had never really been one of the good guys. That's not to say that he was bad. The world he'd grown up in was so far beyond good and bad, you couldn't see them on a clear night with a telescope. But Parker definitely wasn't good. He lied. He cheated. He stole and he manipulated. All for the benefit of one person. Himself. Not once had Parker Luderi ever had to face something that even slightly resembled a consequence for the things he'd done. Not in a way that made him realize that something happening to him was a consequence, anyway. He got by. When a circumstance changed, he adapted, and he didn't give much thought to the things he'd done. But he couldn't stop himself from thinking about this. About Nina. If it had only been Lenny, he could have probably just moved on. After all, you can't make an omelet without breaking a couple of eggs. But it wasn't just Lenny. It was Nina. Parker's actions had killed the person he loved the most, and the ultimate consequence was that there weren't any consequences. The only other person that knew it was his fault would never blame him, so Parker's punishment was that he would spend the rest of his days blaming himself, with no way to make amends. It wasn't much of a memorial. He'd brought flowers to a derelict hole in the ground. The flowers were dead and had been absolved of all of their moisture, but he'd spray-painted them red and blue in hopes of leaving something behind that might last a little while. When Parker caught up to Benj, he found him pushing a 2x4 into the loose dirt at the center of the lot, down in the pit that now existed where their basement used to be. He'd carved their initials into the top of it, along with a T and two M's. Benj thought that there should be something for all the casualties of their foolish endeavor. "Should we say something?" Benj asked as he reached out for Parker's help out of the pit. He thought about what he wanted to say to her almost every day since she'd been taken. But at that moment, Parker Luderi was as uncharacteristically speechless as he'd ever been. Eventually, he just let out a long, slow breath and rubbed his fist against his heart in a circular motion. He knew there was nothing he could say out loud that would have helped anything. Benj allowed for a moment of silence, for his friend to have a moment in the weight of it all. It's not that he didn't feel the guilt as well. He just knew it was harder for Parker. "Do you want to go see Rusty?" Benj suggested. Parker shook his head as a wry smile crept onto his face. "I told you we can't. I gotta work," he responded with regret. "You know, after all of this..." Benj gestured to the world around them, forever altered by their actions. "You having a job might be the strangest thing." Parker laughed. "I'm struggling to deal with it myself." Still chuckling, Benj pulled the device out of his pocket and opened the app. He took one last look down into the pit and then tapped the screen. The two friends felt the familiar tingle of teleportation. It only lasted a second, emanating from the crown of their skulls and racing down to their toes. As the sensation vanished, Parker Luderi and Benj Cave took a deep breath of frigid Midwestern air and grinned at each other. "God," Parker exclaimed, "it smells so much nicer here." "It smells nice, but it's fucking freezing," Benj replied, holding himself tightly. They began walking towards the street from the alleyway they'd been teleported back to when a chime rang out from the inside of Parker's pocket. He let out an exhausted sigh as he dug out an old, beaten-up cell phone. Lightning bolts of cracked screen lit up as he pressed a button, bringing the device to life. On the screen was a text message written in all capital letters from someone who was saved as Boss. "What the fuck, Tucker? Late again?" the words read. "Ah, shit," Parker thought out loud under the burden of responsibility. "You gotta go?" Benj asked. "Oh, yeah," Parker confirmed, expressing the urgency. "What are you doing later?" "Dank's gonna teach me how to play poker," Benj replied, sounding decidedly unsure about the activity. "You two are so fucking cute," Parker said as he patted his pockets looking for something. From the inside of a beaten-up leather jacket that didn't look quite like his old one, but was close enough, Parker pulled out a small orange bottle and tapped out a couple of pills into his hand. "You heard anything about Nina?" Parker asked. The playful tone had vanished from his voice now. The shift took Benj back to the day when they'd gotten out of the shipping container. "Not since she moved," Benj replied. Parker sucked his front teeth like he was considering something, organizing a collection of words he'd had in his head, and deciding whether or not they should be released from between his lips. He'd apparently decided against it, and instead just threw two of the pills into his mouth, dry swallowing them with a grimace. "Probably best," he said solemnly, pausing for a moment before saying anything else. "I'll call you when I get done tonight." The jovial tone had returned to Parker as he offered his friend a handshake. Ben snorted a little laugh and slapped his hand against Parker's before heading off on his own. As he trudged through the snow, Ben thought about the year that had passed since everything happened. It had been quiet, and if you excuse the fact that they were refugees living in the past of an alternate reality, where his best friend had stolen the identity of his doppelganger, life felt like it was approaching something that could be considered adjacent to normal. He wondered how long it would last. And right then, at that very second, like his thoughts of tranquility had lit a beacon in the darkness, letting all of the terrifying things that lived there know exactly where he was, the device in his pocket vibrated. One short but distinct pulse he had felt once before, back at the hospital. Benj stopped as he felt little ripples forming on the surface of reality. He retrieved the device from his pocket with shaking hands. The screen displayed one message from a contact that had been saved simply as someone. "The scales of infinity await." Artwork for Life Without Consequence was provided by Daniel Sewell. You can find him on Twitter at WriterDanSewell. That's DanSoule. Music for this episode was provided by me, Davey Francis. You can find more of my music and access to the Life Without Consequence Patreon at DaveyFrancis.com.